Many supplements on the market are hard to absorb or packed with fillers, but that's not the case with Quiksilver Scientific. Quiksilver Scientific is a U.S.-based company that manufactures advanced liposomal supplements, making nutrients easier for your body to absorb and put to work quickly. Made in Colorado in an NSF GMP-certified facility and rigorously tested, this is science-first supplementation. After adding ultravitamin into my routine, recovery feels faster and I don't hit that midday crash anymore. Trusted worldwide for supplements that truly make a difference in performance, resilience, and well-being. Quiksilver Scientific makes advanced liposomal supplements so you can actually feel the difference. Energy, focus, calm, recovery. Get 10% off plus free shipping at tryqs.com/podcast. That's tryqs.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
Welcome to the Mead Musings podcast.
Here we open discussions on everyday hidden issues.
Like living with disabilities and dealing with illnesses. We also cover issues around conditions such as stroke, diabetes, autism, cancer, leukemia, and also living in abusive relationships. We focus on helping people see the light at the end of the tunnel.
This podcast is available on YouTube and your favorite podcast platform. Please subscribe.
Thanks for listening.
Welcome to another episode of the Mead Musings podcast. My guest today is Catherine Bach, Claren Bach. She is based in Portland, Oregon in the U.S. Welcome to the Mead Musings podcast, Catherine.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I'm delighted to be here.
Oh, well, you're welcome. So please go ahead and introduce yourself and fill in more details, just your background.
Yeah. Sure. I am an ordained Unitarian Universalist minister and also an initiate of the tradition of Stone Circle Wicca. And I work with people who maybe have been wounded by or alienated by traditional religion to find their own deep spirituality. And part of how I came to that work was that I was rejected by my own spiritual community when I was very young. My bipolar illness was really just starting to ramp up. I was untreated with bipolar probably from the time I was 12 or 13, maybe younger, until I was 31. Huge part of my life.
I'm so sorry about your bipolar, but you said you are ordained.
I'm an ordained minister, yes.
And what do you do as an ordained minister? Which religion did you say you affiliate with?
Unitarian Universalism is a relatively small tradition, primarily, but not exclusively based in the United States. We have about 100,000 members in the States, and there are Unitarians in the UK, in Romania, in the Philippines, but they're the largest population of them, and Canada also. The largest population is in the States. And what sort of sets us apart from other religious traditions is that instead of having a list of things that you have to believe about God or Buddha or Jesus or anyone, we have a set of principles that seven principles that help guide how we live together in covenant and guide ethical behavior and justice and equity in human relationships and care for the earth. So there are Unitarian Universalists, we call ourselves UUs, because Unitarian Universalist is such a mouthful. UUs who are Christian, there are UUs who are Jewish, who are Muslim, who are Buddhist, who are Wiccan like me. So there are lots of different beliefs about theology that people have, but we exist in a covenant together to treat each other with love and care. And in my ministry, which is thewayoftheriver.com, that's where you can find it, I connect with people who are wanting to have a spiritual journey and a companion along the way, whether or not they belong to a religious tradition. And so I work with a lot of folk who have been wounded by traditions in the past, or just don't feel connected to traditional religion. I also teach classes on discernment and making good decisions. And I also help other candidates for Unitarian Universalist ministry in their studies for becoming credentialed as a minister.
Oh, thank you.
So that's the work that I do there.
Oh, thank you so much for that introduction. And I'm not familiar with the Way of the River or your Unitarian Universal, but you did mention that you believe in seven principles that guide your behaviors towards other people. What are the seven principles?
The seven principles?
Yeah.
Well, I'll be honest with you, I only have a few of them memorized. you caught me out. The first one is that we believe in the inherent worth and dignity of every human being. And that can be a difficult one when people are not behaving in ways that show their worth and dignity. But we believe that everyone has an inherent value just because they are a part of Earth and a part of humanity. The second principle is justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, which kind of follows from the first one. And then the third one takes that a step further and says acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth. The fourth one is a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. The fifth one is the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations, but also in society at large. And then the last two, the sixth one is the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice. And the seventh one is a really important one to me, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. And we're also considering as a tradition an eighth principle, which would be our commitment to multiculturalism and anti-oppressive behaviors.
All right. These principles sound like just normal principles of relating to other people, and these are just normal. You should be able to respect, to accept, to encourage, to be truthful. The world would be a better place if everybody had that as guiding in their life, you know?
Yes, I agree.
Okay, so yeah, you mentioned also that you were diagnosed with bipolar at an early age. So can you tell us more about that part of your life, please?
Yes, absolutely. From a pretty young age, I mean, I first remember being depressed and suicidal when I was about 6 years old. which was, you know, which is obviously unusual for a child of that age. But I felt I wasn't living up to who I should be or what people wanted of me, or I wasn't good. In a six-year-old's mind, you just want to be good. Then as time went on, once puberty came on when I was like 12 or 13, I started having these tremendous mood swings where I would get really excited and really enthusiastic and really optimistic about something, be full of energy. I wouldn't need a lot of sleep. And then after that, I would crash into a terrible depression to the point that I also was hearing voices as time went on. And it wasn't as though I believed there was another person outside of myself talking to me, but I had a sense there were voices that were constantly telling me to kill myself, that if I had any courage, if I had any integrity, I would kill myself, that the people who loved me would be better off without me. And this was happening all the time.
That was like a self-destructive kind of thought.
They were self-destructive thoughts. And they were also, well, eventually, when I was 18, it got so bad that one night I was walking down the street talking to myself.
Oh, wow.
Just like, you know, when sometimes people see homeless people who have mental illness, who are talking to themselves. I always, my heart goes out to them because I know who they're talking to. I know what that's like.
Oh, yeah. Just because you've been there, you've experienced it. So when you started having these thoughts right from the age of six, did you speak to anybody about it? Was it something that you felt you could confide in your parents or maybe a close friend or family?
When I was 12, I talked to my father about them. And I was very, very close with my father. You know, I told him, I said, I feel like I should kill myself. I feel like killing myself. And he said, darling, when you're 16, you're going to look back on this time and see it really differently. And I said, Daddy, you're not listening to me. I don't believe I'm going to live to be 16. And it was just crushing to him, you know, to hear that from your own child. And this was in the 80s, I should say, when we didn't have a lot of understanding of what was then called manic depressive illness, as much as we do now with bipolar disorder.
Yeah. Were there specific triggers or anything that made it worse for you at that time?
One of the things that was true, bipolar often has the onset that right around the early to mid-teens, for some reason, is triggered by hormonal changes in a person's body. And then in my case, it really ramped up over time to the point that I couldn't hold on to reality. I couldn't hold on to what was really going on around me because I was so oppressed by the voices in my head.
Oh, wow. That,
it was real. It was just terrible.
That sounds really horrible for a child to have to go through.
Mm-hmm.
As at that time, I know that even medical practitioners or your family, they didn't really understand what was going on.
Right.
That's why, right. I mean, like when you said you spoke to your dad about it and he just waved it with the back of the hand saying, oh, darling, you're going to feel different about this when you're 16.
And, and in fact, when I was a little bit older, when I was 15 or 16, I injured myself. I cut up my arm in that sort of cry for help. We went to our family doctor and asked him about it. And he said, she'll grow out of it.
Oh,
yeah.
And that's a doctor saying that? Did they take any action to help you at all? That's really shocking. that at that age you had this problem and you needed a fixing, you needed somebody to understand this is what was going on in your mind, in the inside of you, and even a medical doctor couldn't help you. How did you cope through the years? How did you get on?
It's a little bit funny. I came to believe, like, different voices in my head had different names. Like, I identified them as different individuals. And I just thought of this as a creative way of dealing with my depression, that it was evidence, because I knew that they weren't outside myself. I knew that they were part of me, even though they felt kind of separate. It's hard to explain. But I, for example, in my early 20s, I saw a psychologist who did a psych evaluation of me and still didn't catch it because I was at the time in what is called hypomania, which means just below mania, right? So it's a time when you have a lot of energy. For example, I hate housework.
Okay.
But once when I was hypomanic, I cleaned the entire downstairs of my house.
Right. Okay.
And my wife came home and she was like, what happened? So I had a lot of energy and I was very persuasive when I was talking to the psychologist. And so was a little bit like, you know, do you ever get depressed? And I said, oh, yes. Like, I was very clear that I had depression recurrently. But I had tried to tell someone, I was hospitalized when I was 18, and I tried to say, I think I'm manic depressive. I think I am bipolar. And in the hospital, they wouldn't listen. It was the late 80s, early 90s, and there was a whole scheme, a whole belief system in the psychological sort of arena called repressed memory syndrome. I don't know. They decided that I had repressed memory syndrome.
All right. And whilst you were in hospital, they now diagnosed you with repressed memory syndrome whilst you were in hospital. Is that right?
Yes, they diagnosed me with repressed memory syndrome.
Did they give you any treatment for that or why? Or
no.
How?
No. So I left in worse shape than I was when I got there. If I could burn that building to the ground, I would. Because they didn't help me. Right? Yes. They didn't help me. I was desperate. I was 18 years old. They did not listen to me.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I think is really important about mental illness and dealing with mental illness is to listen to people when they say what is happening to them. You know, we don't always have the full picture, but that doctor didn't listen to me. My father, though he loved me very much, didn't really listen. And when I was in the hospital, they didn't listen.
Oh, yes, I know. It's not just about mental illness alone. Any illness at all, it's only you, the one who has that illness, who knows how the illness affects you.
That's right.
Sometimes you could have anxiety and you could be okay 1 minute and the next minute, everybody will see you, you're okay. I mean, look at what happened to Robin Williams. That he was so depressed. And
people didn't know.
To everyone, he had it all. It was fulfilled. It was rich. It was an actor. It was popular. And everybody saw
it. And what I would add about him that's interesting is that he was also a white man. Right? Like he had, I mean, very, very often people of color, especially Black people, are not listened to by doctors. And people who are heavier than average are not listened to by doctors. And women are often not listened to by doctors.
That's why we all develop coping mechanisms. These coping mechanisms are not the best ways to handle illnesses. Well, I would prefer they speak to you about what is going on with you. Let somebody even ask you questions. How are you feeling? What does this thing do to you? I mean, when you have these incidents, what happens, you know? Because you could be okay 1 minute. And if you're like a suicidal person, somebody could just be like, okay, I've had it all. And they take a jump in the river or they jump in front of a train. So these are things that I think the medical system has failed a lot of people over the years. Right now, for anybody that has bipolar, I got this information about a website where you could contact people. They would chat with you. For people living with bipolar specifically, it's www.bipolarcaregivers.org. So I think it's a global thing. You can just log on and there will be somebody there that you can chat with.
Yeah. And they, you don't have to know for sure that you have bipolar disorder to connect with them. If you feel like you have mood swings and you don't understand, and there are basically three types of bipolar disorder. There is what's called cyclothymia, which is basically having significant mood swings.
Okay.
There is bipolar 2, which is more significant than, or more difficult to manage than cyclothymia, but is not as significant as bipolar 1 in terms of how difficult it is to manage. And I have bipolar 1. And I have, because I have it with voices, it's called bipolar 1 with psychotic features. And we have this, we use this word psychotic, right, to mean someone who is committing evil or someone who is a serial killer.
Yeah, like a psychopath.
A psychopath, right. We'll say, oh, they're psychotic.
Yeah.
And that always gets to me a little bit, right? Because I have that diagnosis myself. And I'm somebody who, when I finally figured it out, when I really, really, really figured it out with the help of my wife and of a dear friend who was a social worker, and then eventually with a helpful psych.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Psychiatrist, thank God. When I finally figured it out, it turned out that medication was amazingly helpful. And I had not wanted to go on medication. I was very reluctant to do
Why were you reluctant to go on medication?
Well, I really think there is a tremendous stigma about being on medication other than antidepressants or possibly anti-anxiety drugs, because they're much more common now.
You said you figured it out with your wife. How did you figure it out?
It's kind of a funny story, actually. We belonged to a choir, a singing choir that was about an hour away from our house. And we would go every Tuesday night and drive up to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in the U.S., where our choir was. And she was telling me about this book that she was reading a memoir. She loves memoir. And it was called The Day the Voices Stopped. And it was actually written by a man who had schizophrenia. And he had schizophrenia for years and years and years. And then finally got on medication. It was unbelievably helpful for him. And suddenly the voices stopped. He was well. One of the things that was in the book that Julie was interested in, my wife was interested in, was the description of the voices. And part of the description of the voices was that you didn't have to believe that they were outside of yourself. You could understand that it was just a trick of your mind. And that still counted as what are called auditory hallucinations or voices. And I said to her, what do you mean those count as voices? And she said, what do you mean? What do I mean? and I said, well, I've had that for 20 years.
Yeah.
And she was like, what? And then we arrived at choir practice and we had to sing for 2 hours. And then get back in the car and talk about it some more. And then I called my friend who is a social worker and who himself has had very well-treated bipolar disorder. And he there's a book called The Diagnostic Statistical Manual, which helps people diagnose
different illnesses,
different illnesses, exactly. And he got it out and we looked at, you had to have 4 out of 7
symptoms,
characteristics to qualify as having bipolar 1. Well, I had 6 out of the 7.
Oh, wow.
And so I was finally like, oh my goodness, this is the thing.
Yeah.
I've been right all along. And it was really after that, that he convinced me that if medication had helped millions of other people around the world to deal with mental illness, it might be able to help me too. And I had had such a bad experience when I was 18 that I was very reluctant to go see a psychiatrist, but I did. And I had the most wonderful psychiatrist I could have possibly asked for.
So wonderful to know. It's so nice when you finally get to the bottom of things, when you know you've been going through it's like a tormenting period in your life.
Yes.
And this has tormented you for 20 years. And then finally somebody says, this is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and I went on medication and the voices just stopped.
Number one, how did you feel when it was diagnosed, when it was like, this was recognized for you?
By the doctor?
Yes.
Well, the doctor was young. He was a resident. He was this young, biracial, very friendly man who was actually a hip-hop DJ on the side. And so he was not my stereotypical idea of a psychiatrist at all. I met him and I was like, what?
Did you say to him, can you please get me the doctor?
Well, I thought maybe he was like gonna do an intake, but he wasn't the doctor. But his tag said doctor with his name. And I was like, okay. It was so funny. Between you and me and our listeners, we called him Dr. Cutie Pants. He made the diagnosis and prescribed a couple of medications. And then after our second meeting, I said to him, because he hadn't actually told me, here's your diagnosis. And I said, so do I have bipolar disorder? And his response was really funny. He looked at me and he smiled and he said, oh, yeah. That's affirming, right?
Yeah.
Like, and I actually called my mother and I explained to her what had happened and how all the strange things that had happened when I was growing up, all the fear that she had had for my life, once my parents knew that I was suicidal sometimes. Oh. She cried. She was so grateful
that somebody finally says, wow, this is what it is. This is the diagnosis.
Yes, yes.
I don't even want to imagine what you went through all that period. I don't imagine it's a nice feeling.
No.
I don't imagine it was nice for your mom. I don't imagine it was nice for your dad. But because they didn't really understand what was going on with you, they couldn't help you.
That's right.
Yeah.
Which was really scary for them.
Ooh. So I would just want to say here, for anybody feeling suicidal or anybody going through similar situation, the National Suicide Prevention Support is open. I mean, you can chat with them privately and confidentially. And the number for them is 0800-273-8255. There's always somebody there to chat with. The Samaritans are also there. They are on 116-123. And there's also CALM, which is a campaign against living miserably. The number.
I love that.
It is a charity organization here in the UK. And the number for them is 0800-585858. They also offer confidential web chat. And also,
wonderful.
Yeah. Do you have such charities or organizations?
Well, we do have the National Suicide Prevention Hotline.
Yeah.
I don't know the number off the top of my head. You would have to look it up online, but it's the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. And there's also the National Alliance for Mental Illness, NAMI, and they do a lot of wonderfully good work. And they're a nonprofit as well.
Okay. And I actually have some organizations based in the U.S. that I researched over the internet, and they are called Anxiety and Depression Association of America. There's also Hope for Depression. It's a group of charities. They are based around New York, Illinois, Virginia, Washington, and in Illinois they have the Depression and Bipolar Support Alliance. And in New York they have the America Foundation for Suicide Prevention. And in Virginia, it's just the National Mental Health Association. And the, in Washington, D.C., there's the American Psychological Association. And then the National Mental Health Information Center is available as well. So for anyone feeling or going through similar situation or just having problems, I mean, having these very traumatic feelings and difficult to explain emotions when you just hear voices in your head, when you just don't feel like you want to live to see the next day or even the next minute, please
talk to somebody. Yes, contact someone.
Yeah, talk to somebody. Yeah. Even if it's the emergency number you pick up, just dial 999. Somebody will be there to speak to you and is just offer you confidential advice over the phone or go on the internet, chat to somebody. Just don't take that action to take your life. Life is, I mean, it's difficult right now. All emotional is getting to people. So it's triggering a lot of mental health issues. This is why I'm really passionate about this. I want people to just know that their life matters.
Life
matters.
And something that has helped me is when I have been really struggling the most, to make a promise to a friend or family member that I would not hurt myself without reaching out to them and talking to them.
Oh, that's so nice.
It's been very, very helpful because it's like making a pact.
Yeah.
Right? And it's really helped me in the past.
When you harm yourself or you commit suicide, it breaks people's hearts when you go. It's not that people don't love you. They love you. They just, I mean, like your mom, your dad, they love you. Other people that you've been in contact with, the psychologists, the doctors, the nurses, all from your experience, every one of them, all of them loved you. They just didn't know how to help you. So, I mean, picking up the phone, talking to somebody, even if it's a friend, just pick up your phone and just, even if it's the 999 number, the 911, anywhere you are located, call the emergency number. The 5 minutes that you pick the phone, in that 5 minutes, something happens to you. You go through another thought process by talking to somebody. And that helps you to regroup or to refocus on what is happening. There's so many good things that will still happen.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think because I have bipolar disorder, as well as various other difficulties that I've had in my life, it's part of why I'm able to do my work, is to understand part of, to have the empathy to understand people's difficulties and to recognize that we're all doing our best with the tools that we have at the time.
And what sort of people do you come across now with your current work? As a religious leader, you said you are an ordained minister. Ordained minister, and also how has your experience with bipolar, how has it changed you for the better?
Well, Julie and I had been married a year when we figured this out. And so it takes years to really recover from bipolar disorder, to really figure out what's going on, to get the right kinds of meds, to learn how to cope in ways that are different from the ways you've coped for your previous period of life. And I was very lucky that I have a very stubborn spouse. And she stood by me throughout the years of figuring that out and working on that. So in that way, my life is certainly, certainly for the better. Also, as I said, as a spiritual leader, it is my obligation to reach out to people who are suffering, who have been abandoned, who have been alienated, or who just feel like there's no space for them in a religious context, and help them to feel like there's a safe space for them. And that's really what I do in my work, is to create a loving, attentive space for people who may not feel connected in religious community.
All right. And like you say, you make people feel safe in your community. So can you describe, I mean, the kind of different people you come across every day on a regular basis?
Well, it's interesting, actually. There are sort of two different kinds of people I work with. And one is who you might expect, right? People who have been in religious organizations where they grew up in them, but then for whatever reason, they're not part of that community anymore. So like several of my clients are lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender, because there wasn't room, there wasn't space, there wasn't love for them in their religious communities when they came out. So that's one thing. But another community that you might not realize feels distant from their own spiritual practice are people who are themselves religious professionals.
Oh, wow.
Because you become, for example, a congregational minister because you love congregational life, right? Because you enjoy the feeling of working together with other people towards common goals with a common spiritual outlook. But then, and you go to temple or church on Friday or Saturday or Sunday. But then when you become a religious leader, a congregational leader, it's like you never get to just go to church ever again. Because now you're in charge of it. Like, you can't just have the consolation and the sense of camaraderie anymore.
Oh.
Because you are longing for that spiritual connection, but other people are demanding it of you.
Yeah.
So I make a space for people who serve others to just relax and have someone listen to them.
Oh, that's so nice, because I think we are all human beings and we have bodies at different times in our lives. Mm-hmm. And if you are giving and giving and giving all the time, you need to be the one receiving at a different level.
Yes, at the other side of the table.
Yeah. So like a shepherd that is being shepherded.
Yeah. Well, sometimes I say that I minister to ministers.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, as well as to people who feel like they don't have their own religious home.
Oh, that's so nice.
Can find more, you know, I mentioned it earlier, but there's lots and lots of information about me at thewayoftheriver.com.
Okay. And has anything changed with the way you minister to your congregation?
To the people I work with?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't become a minister until after I had been diagnosed with bipolar for several years.
Yeah.
Because I went back and finished my undergraduate degree in my early 30s.
Mm.
And then I was 40 years old when I was ordained. It was a long process. And I was first initiated in Stone Circle Wicca much longer ago, in 1999. That is a place where I really derive. That's my place where I derive a lot of spiritual nurturance. Whereas in Unitarian Universalist contexts, I'm often, I preach sometimes at different congregations, and I'm often the one who is giving, right? And in my Wiccan community, we have a different kind of bond because I've been with them for so long.
Well, it sounds like you have come to a comfortable place in your life now. So,
yes.
Yeah, that's great to know. And you mentioned that your website is wayoftheriver.com.
Right, it's actually the way of the river.
The way of the river.
Yeah, because way of the river gets you somewhere else.
Oh, wow. Okay. It's the way of the river.
Right. Exactly. .com.
Okay. And do you have other social media platforms?
I have a Facebook community group that folks are welcome to ask to join. That's primarily where I connect with folks outside of my website. You know, if you want to send me a note through my contact page on my website, I'd love to hear from you. Just if you have any questions at all or are interested in considering working with someone who's just going to listen and be a companion for you as you try to figure out your spiritual life.
All right. So thank you so much for sharing your story, even though it's been a difficult story. You've made it sound like it's not so bad, but I know it would have been awful.
It was terrible.
Yeah.
But now.
Oh, thank you. All right. You take care of yourself and just keep being good, keep being respectful of others, and whatever you do, stay safe.
Thank you. Be careful. I will be.
Okay.
Thank you for having me. Oh, you're welcome.
A big thank you to all our listeners who have been sending us messages through the message link. I would like to thank everyone who has listened in so far and contributed to this podcast. Thank you so much. We couldn't have done anything without you. Keep listening, keep sharing, keep downloading, and keep liking. Thank you again.
This
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters' 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at USAHockeyNTDP.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.